Yeah, welcome everybody, and welcome to those of you here in Parramatta. We're in the land of the Barramattagal people of the Darug Nation, and the people after whom the city of Parramatta are named lived here for a long time. We don't really know how long they lived here, so we usually say that the Aboriginal people have been on this land like the kind of the Western way or the sort of modern way of counting it. We say like 50,000 or 60,000 years. But Aboriginal people themselves will say that they've been here since time immemorial. But during that time, of course, things were not static. Everything was changing all the time. So the fact that Aboriginal people were here in Australia for that time does not mean that the Barramattagal people were here in Parramatta for that time. And in fact, the boundaries and the nations and those kinds of things were changing quite frequently. So we can't really say how long the Barramattagal people as such were here on this land, but they were certainly here for a long time. And they maintained the land. When white folks first came to Sydney, they wrote accounts, and you can read about it in some of the accounts of the early colonists, that they were like riding their horses underneath the trees, which was like a whole park-like environment that they could ride through and so on. And the land, the Sydney area, Sydney Basin, was the most densely populated area in Australia and had quite sophisticated like irrigation and fishing techniques and all of these kinds of things. So it supported quite a large population in those days. So the Barramattagal people were here and they looked after the land and they provided an example of how humans can exist in mutual flourishing with the land. And that's going to be a topic that we're going to be returning to this evening as we have a special guest with us. Meanwhile, we actually have a couple of special guests today. Also, just to mention that the fact that we have some special guests is thanks to the Meta Center for getting everything together, pulling everyone around and bringing everyone to Sydney. So congratulations, bringing them to the literal end of the world here in Parramatta. So people ask me, why did you call your monastery in Parramatta the monastery at the end of the world? And that by that way, I can tell who's actually lives in Sydney and who doesn't, because people who live in Sydney would know the answer to that. Anyhow, moving along. Moving along, shall we do some chanting? Yes. Do we have chanting sheets? We had chanting sheets at this Friday night group, and we seem to have lost them, right?
On Wednesday nights.
We have them on Wednesdays. We used to have them on the Friday nights, and at some point, they seem to have disappeared.
Someone stored them somewhere.
Someone stored them somewhere for safekeeping. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. They'll be there safe and sound. So lovely. That's so lovely. Yeah, it's excellent. So, look, we're only here for a little bit further. So, just so people know, in fact, the last talk here will be on the 5th of December. So, just so people locally know that and the people online also know, so 5th of December will be the last one for this year. And we're starting up on next year on 16th of January, so taking a bit of a break. And next year we will be starting in a new venue because the lease on this place is expiring and we haven't sorted out that new venue yet. So if you know of any venues, let me know. Yay. Meanwhile, we keep looking. All right. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi,
Dutiyam Bhutam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyam Namam Saranam Gacchami. Dutiyam Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyam Bhutam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyam Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. Tatiyam Sangham Saranam Gacchami.
Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammā sambuddho
vijjācharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhammasārathi Sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati Svakato bhagavata dhammo Sandipiko akaliko Ehipasiko opanayiko Achatam veditabho vinyuhiti Supatipanno bhagavato sāvakasangho Ujjupatipanno bhagavato sāvakasangho Nyāyapatipanno bhagavato sāvakasangho Samici patipanno bhagavato sāvaka sangho Yadidam chatari purisa yugani Artha purisa pungala Esa bhagavato sāvaka sangho Ahuneyo, pahuneyo, dakirneyo, anjali karaniyo, anuttaram punyaketam lokasati.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu. Okay, very good. So for this evening's meditation, I'd like to invite my Dhamma friend, Venerable Siddhaso, to give the meditation. I think most of you have met Venerable Siddhaso, so I'm not going to introduce him again, except to say, you know, my own personal memory. I remember Venerable's kindness putting me up in Rockaway. It was -5 degrees and there was no hot water. So that was a memorable shower or two that was had. At that particular juncture in history, and we went around various places in New York, gave some talks and so on, in art galleries and so on, and it was fun. And I could see from that the spirit that both Venerable Siddhaso and Venerable Soma were bringing that was so inspiring to so many people and connecting with people in a way that seemed... I don't know, seem natural, but also seems like much more rare than it should be just to be able to actually talk this genuine Dhamma, but also in a way that connects with people. It seems like that's should be the normal thing, but it somehow isn't. But anyway, so I'll hand you over to Venerable Siddhaso for the meditation.
Okay. So... first off, thank you, Bhante Sujato, for inviting me to lead the meditation this evening and for those kind words. We can go ahead and start by getting in a stable, upright position. And just starting by taking a few long, slow, deep breaths. Letting your body settle into stillness. So making the determination to Let your body be still. Bring a slight smile to your lips. And just checking the state of your mind, if your mind is feeling at all blurry or sleepy or dull, then keep your eyes slightly open for the whole period of meditation. And also at any time during the meditation, if you start to feel a bit sleepy or blurry, then open your eyes. So again, with a gentle smile, taking a few deep breaths, and just dropping away all of our memories and plans. For the next few minutes, there's nothing we need to remember. There's nothing we need to analyze, nothing we need to think about. We can just bring our full attention to an intense, joyful awareness of our physical experience. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. All five aspects of the body. You allow these sensations to appear in the mind, and we allow them to disappear. So bringing a full, motionless attention to our entire sensorium in each moment. And when thoughts drift through the mind, we let them come and go without reacting to them. Just like overhearing someone else's conversation. We're aware of the words, but we take no interest in them. We take no part in them. In the same way, when thoughts drift through the mind, we are aware of the thoughts, but we do not take part in them. We just let them come and go without reacting. Constantly coming back to an intense, motionless awareness of our whole body, moment by moment. aware of sensations, emotions, thoughts, but not spinning stories about them. Just letting them flow through the field of awareness, unaltered, untouched. Like watching a river flowing on without moving from our seat by the riverside. In the same way, we watch the flow of sensations and impressions without moving body and mind. With each moment, letting the body and mind become increasingly still. With each moment, increasing the intensity and clarity of awareness. With each moment, cultivating enjoyment and pleasure in this serene alertness, this peaceful clarity. with each breath, increasing the intensity of awareness. With each breath, increasing the intensity of joy. As we come towards the end of the meditation, just taking a moment to observe the quality of the mind, observing if there's any improvement in serenity, clarity, joy, from when we started the period of meditation. Appreciating any development in wholesome qualities of mind. We can take a few long, slow, deep breaths. Open our eyes all the way. We can bring our hands together in Anjali. And we'll say sadhu together three times.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
You can take a moment to gently rock your body side to side, gently massage or stretch your limbs, rubbing your knees, your shoulders, your back, anything that gets a bit sore or tense, you can give it a few minutes to recuperate. So keeping a sense of serenity and attention as we resume a little bit of movement. Okay, so thank you, Bhante Sujato, for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Okay. And I'll pass things back over to Venerable Bhante for the rest of the session.
So I'm here with Venerable Tenzin. Now I'm just going to try to get us both on the camera. How are we going with that? Might move over here. So, sorry, your full name again, Venerable Tenzin?
Ngawang Tenzin.
Ngawang Tenzin. Ngawang Tenzin. Yeah. But everyone calls you Venerable Tenzin.
Yeah, easier to pronounce.
Okay, excellent. And we're going to be trying to do the talks here together, and I just want to check with the folks online, how are we going for sound? Is it okay?
Can you hear me also?
Yeah, so hi everybody. Little quick comment here before we start from Scott, who mentions about the beautiful talk by Venerable Sanatu Vihari at the Metta Center, when am I using Dhamma to mask the trauma? Or as he said, you have made the holy unholy. A hard-hitting talk. So, and Scott asks if we discuss some more on that topic. We won't be discussing that topic today, Scott, because we already have another topic in mind. But it is a really interesting question, and definitely something that deserves consideration. Okay, so but thanks for bringing that up. So for this evening's talk, we wanted to talk about deeper ecology, right? That's the title we agreed on before. Deeper ecology. So Michael, if you're there, oh yeah, there you go, Michael. Now you have a title, okay? So you don't have to worry about it. Deeper ecology. shall I just do a bit of an intro? And then we can have a bit of back and forth.
Please.
Shall we do that?
Please, yeah.
Okay, so I know the term deep ecology from when I was a philosophy student back in the 80s. And in those days, there was sort of a contrast between what they called deep ecology and shallow environmentalism. Mm-hmm. And basically, deep ecology was like, we are all living as beings interconnected with nature. We are part of nature. We operate within it, and our lives manifest as an aspect of nature. Whereas shallow environmentalism was, we're going to now produce our McDonald's with a paper wrapping rather than a plastic wrapping. Mm. So you can tweak and change a few little bits and pieces here and there in the name of caring for the environment. And I mean, I'm presenting it in a slightly satirical way, but only slightly. I mean, that's literally what they did in the early 90s, McDonald's. They did an environmental review of all of their products. And of course, McDonald's is massively responsible for deforestation in the Amazon. And they did this whole environmental review, and the outcome of the review was that they used paper for their things rather than foam, polystyrene they used before, which is good, definitely better to use paper than polystyrene. But the whole decimation of the Amazon thing is also perhaps worth paying attention to. Anyway, so at that time, so there were these two philosophical approaches, and I think it's fairly clear that, generally speaking, the shallow environmentalist approach has prevailed in what mainstream we think of as environmentalism. I just read an article, just as an illustration, just today, they're proposing a massive 50,000 hectare solar farm in the Northern Territory to power an AI data center. Mm. And so, again, from sort of shallow environmental point of view, we say solar power is good, right? Because it's less harmful than coal or fossil fuels. But then your 50,000 hectares is a lot of land. It's one of the world's biggest solar projects. The home of endangered species like the bilby and so on, massively impacting water resources, their communities locally who are also going to be negatively impacted and they won't be helped by this and so on and so forth. But it's being marketed as green and sustainable energy. So this, again, is this example of that shallow environmentalism that seems like, if you say it's a solar project, okay, that's great, but actually the reality is that the reality is, why are we building AI data centers in the first place? Mm-hmm. It's not actually solving or addressing a real need that people have. So, I often feel like that one of the big flaws in that approach is its flaw is to say, you can have everything you want and never have to pay the cost, rather than to say there's always a cost. And so anyway, that's a little introduction to deep ecology versus shallow environmentalism. And I think from the perspective of the suttas, the Buddha was obviously a deep ecologist, and he very much saw us in a network of relationship with nature and so on. Mm. But anyway, tell me about your work or your perspective about that. Yeah,
thank you so much, Bhante. Thank you, everyone, online and in person, and for the opportunity. Really feel honored to be able to join a conversation and have been touched by your persistent recognition of the importance of ecological issues and also, like, issues around our, here in Australia, our connection to country as well. I have the sense that this, as for me, is a topic close to your heart. So thanks again. And yeah, I'm curious actually, maybe I'm not sure if you can raise your hands in Jitsi, but if you can, yeah, in the room here and online, who has heard of deep ecology before? So we clearly have a marketing issue there. the message doesn't seem to be getting out yet. And this to me is something in itself to look at. But I think what Bhante has shared is true, that actually in being Dhamma practitioners, actually you already know a lot about deep ecology in a sense. And I think we'll kind of circle back around, I hope, to why we just on the spur of the moment kind of came up with this title, Deeper Ecology. But first of all, yeah, just to echo from your introduction, Bhante, the contrast. So ecology, in this context, we're not so much talking about the science of ecology, though I think more and more we need to be looking at how we can deepen that understanding as well. Because in the European context, in which one of the originators or the philosopher who coined the term, right, ecology kind of stands in for environmentalism, really. It's about kind of the activist end of the spectrum, people who are engaging in actions for the protection of the natural world. But the kind of hallmark of the shallow end of the spectrum that Arne Næss, philosopher, a Norwegian philosopher who in 1973 wrote the essay that coined the term deep ecology, he was really pointing to the instrumental value of nature that was seen by kind of the broad environmental movement. So conserving nature because it is valuable to people. Conserving water because we need clean water to drink. Protecting the forests because we need oxygen to breathe, protecting the oceans because we need fish to eat. All of these kind of things, the reason for the protection, the conservation being from the side of utility to human beings. Whereas the deep...
Which is where you get language like resources.
Right? And ecosystem services, like right, this economic language right, around something, you know, as unfathomably vast and beautiful as, you know, the whole of the biosphere, yeah, trying to dice it up into parts that can be bought and sold and traded. Carbon offsetting is another way that this sort of mentality manifests.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
So the deep aspect then comes in this recognition, as Bhante shared, that actually if we look beyond that, there is no way to put it any more clearly than to say that we are actually the biosphere. We are just a small part of a completely interconnected web of living systems supporting one another in what often are hidden ways. And it would almost be as that's if we applied the same logic to our own bodies, yeah, it would be to say, you know, like for me to say to someone, well, how much is your left hand worth? You don't use it so much, you know. So mostly you just use the right hand. So, you know, can we just have that? You know, what's the value of your left hand, you know, compared to your right? It's literally when we look at how interconnected we are with all living systems, it's really those kinds of questions that we ought to be asking ourselves, you know, what and where we come to, I suppose, in the deep ecology kind of movement. The question that was posed by the original author, Arne Næss, and then by a group who wrote a book together proposing a structure for this is processes that we can go through as a community to help us to understand that, to what Joanna Macy calls see with new eyes, actually to recognize our interconnectedness with all life. So Arne Næss put it very clearly, what we need is not more ecological ideas. We have those from the science of ecology. Everything you learn in your high school science class about ecology is about interconnection. What we need is ecological identity. We need to identify ourselves as part of those living systems, as not separate from them, so that when we cut off part of them, we are recognizing that it is as though we are cutting off part of ourselves.
Right. Mm. Yeah. And I'm reminded of things like this is always like an understanding in any, I think, deep spiritual tradition. And I'm reminded of something like, say, the Hindu idea of the Purusha, that the universe is a giant person or a giant man, and that all the different aspects are actually different, like the same as same as you. So when we're harming it, we're harming the outside. And the things, like you see things in the like the in one of the texts that I refer to a lot in this context is the Aganya Sutta, where the Buddha text talks about the creation of the world, not really creation, but the renewal of the cycle of the world. And the environment evolves and changes, and it evolves and changes in concert with human desire. You know, our desires for food especially are shaping the environment, and we know that that's a fact, that humans have been reshaping the environment for thousands and thousands of years. And it always really strikes me when I see that, you know, that's it's driven by greed. That's the primal thing, right? Because we want more than we need, and we keep taking more than we need. And it even just starts with something very simple, like, oh, I'm going to take enough for tomorrow as well as today, right? And it seems very innocuous. Like today we wouldn't even think twice about that. But it's already starting to take more. And then that's the tipping point that leads to that kind of imbalance in it. I'm always kind of really struck by the fact that we've had like environmentalism, all of this stuff for a long time now. I mean, my whole life, you know, and I'm almost dead. So that's a long time. And we still can't even, like, we can't begin to conceive of a human culture, a technology, a society, an economy that actually promotes the abundance and flourishing of the whole world. The very best we can do is to think about one that's going to minimize the damage. And the damage that we've done is already so massive. We really cannot comprehend it. Just one statistic is that almost all mammalian life on this planet has been eliminated. Almost all mammalian life on the planet is and things that human beings eat. The amount of cats and dogs on the planet is more than all of the wild mammals on the planet put together. The amount that we have changed everything, not to mention the insects, not to mention the fish, not to mention the forest, all of those things, the amount we've changed things, incomprehensibly vast, beyond reason, beyond anything that we can possibly imagine. And yet still we are fighting for some kind of small minimization or small optimization to be able to reduce it. Where, of course, at the moment, the COP30 is still ongoing, I think coming to a conclusion and burning down in the meantime. I don't know if you saw that on the news.
Oh, no.
But COP30 was burnt down. So, yeah. That was a bit of an overly apt metaphor for that whole process. But anyway, and the funniest thing was a photo of everyone running away from this burning building, and they all had their hands like this, which was a great metaphor for the world running away.
Wow.
And everyone like, whatever. Okay, so, yeah, so that idea that, like, can we envisage a world where we live in the flourishing of nature.
This is for me also a thread that I think is an important one, and you spoke just now about the images, even from like deep layers of Hindu mythology and so on.
Right.
And actually, when we start to unpack some of the influences on Arne Naess and the other thinkers that have contributed a lot to not just the philosophy of deep ecology, but actually the group process that I'm referring to, we find that Arne Naess, for example, was deeply inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, for example, and the Satyagraha movement. So a liberation activism rooted in non-dual philosophy, rooted in a recognition of non-separation between self and other, between human being and the world. And then other, specifically Buddha Dhamma influences really coming through. John Seed was someone who in Australia engaged in the first direct action in defense of rainforest, possibly in the world. That happened just here in northern New South Wales at Terania Creek in the late 70s. And he was involved in setting up Bodhi Farm and forest meditation center at Dharmananda. So came out of the forest from a meditation, realizing that what he felt was that he was a part of the forest, stepping up in its own defense, able to speak for itself, or speak in on behalf of the forest.
Right. That's a really beautiful way of thinking of it, isn't it? Like we've evolved to be the spokesperson for nature.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's not to sort of deny our humanity that recognition of connection is not a negation of our humanity. It's an augmentation. It's saying we are the forest, but given this power to speak on behalf of those who cannot. Mm-hmm. And Joanna Macy also is someone who co-authored this book, Thinking Like a Mountain. If those of you are interested to find that, it's very widely available now, including on our website, deepecology.net. In a freely available form, you can read. She came through her university career with a fascination for Paticca-samutpada. So her doctoral dissertation was in interdependent co-arising, and she saw that as a very powerful tool for understanding the situation that we're in as human beings, and it led her to combine that understanding with anti-nuclear activism in the US. So just a couple of examples of the way that those sorts of experiences and understandings led those thinkers to see the urgency of the situation, but also the way out, to recognize that it's, as in the sutta you mentioned, the root of the problem is something that lies not out there, but in our own mind. And this, for me, makes the Buddha perhaps the deepest ecologist in that sense, looking not, I mean, ecology, the word itself implies understanding our home, where we dwell.
Right, but it's also systems, right? Ecology is systems, and the Buddha looked at things from a systemic basis. That's what Joanna Macy was looking into. Because she worked with Sarvodaya in Sri Lanka.
Absolutely. Yeah,
which is still very active today, and they still do a lot of great work in villages and so on. Mm. I've had a couple of talks there and had some connection with them in Sri Lanka, and they're really good people. And what was his name, the guy running Sarvodaya? He died a few years ago. What's his name again? Arya...
I know who you mean. I also can't put my...
Anyway, yeah. Fantastic guy, very impish, very mischievous, and always wanting to, wanting to try to change things, always very clear-eyed and wanting to just try to lift up. And he saw this connection, because Sri Lanka is a very traditional Buddhist place, and he saw this connection between the Buddha's teachings and how they're living and what they're wanting to do. And there is something that's very meaningful about that, and just on a practical level, like if you look practically how Buddhism manifests in Sri Lanka or Thailand and so on, most of the time for most people it manifests at a village level. And villages are the most adaptive and resilient form of human living, basically, or certainly one of them. And they're all over the world. People get together, smallish groups of people, and they have a long-term connection with that piece of land. So they know, when are the rains going to be coming, where are the winds going to be blowing, what are the plants that are going to be growing, and they know they have generational knowledge which is passed down, which is like an integrated knowledge which is local. And the other thing that really strikes me is that, like, in the ancient Vedas, the Hindu texts, and as well as in the suttas and so on, you see there's so much divinity in nature, right? The sun is a god, the skies are gods, the wind is gods, the trees are gods, the water is gods, the earth is gods. Everything around us is gods. And we don't really see that. Like when we do like a earth element, in Buddhism, we talk about the earth element meditation, and we just say, it's just dirt, right? But the earth is actually a god, or a goddess more specifically. And there is a connection with something which is very meaningful through seeing that divinity. I mean, I'm not saying whether literally it's a god or not. I'm talking about how you're seeing it. And if you're living in a world where you are surrounded by divinity, and there is the sacred in every fallen leaf, and in every drop of rain, and in every sparkle of sunshine, and where you have a teaching that tells you that whenever you kindle the fire, that this is a gift of the gods, then that changes how the sense of meaning that you have within that space. Mm. And I'm really sort of, you know, and it's very easy to look at it from a modern perspective and say, you know, now we have science, blah, blah, blah. But it's when we stop seeing nature as divine that we started destroying the world.
Mm. Yeah.
That's just what happened. You know, 200-300 years ago, we had industry. We realized, oh, we don't have to worship the goddess to make our crops grow. We can just put some fertilizer on it. Mm. Crops grow up anyway. So bad luck, goddess, you're out.
Mm.
And now we can do that. And we now think in a completely different way. It's very alien for us. We have to sort of, if we are to see nature as divine, then we have to think in a completely archaic or completely different way. And yet somehow that has changed the way that we position ourselves and the way that we live within nature. So thanks, Chandima. Ariaratna, yes, thanks. Yeah, Ati Ariaratna, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, should have remembered.
Yeah, indeed. And this really reminds me of one of the other important influences on Aniness. Actually, he was fascinated by the work of Baruch Spinoza. So this is a philosopher who was actually excommunicated from his Jewish community for the view that everything was divine, actually, a pantheistic view, which in some sense creates some very, very tricky problems for religious traditions that are seeking to act as a conduit for the divine,
right?
Because you finish up with the problem, well, if everything is divine, then nothing is sacred as well. You have like this conflict, you know.
Well, more to the point, you don't have to give a donation to the church.
Yeah, but what they portray as the main problem is that if you finish up as nothing is sacred, you know, if everything is divine, right, then even, you know, even the unwholesome becomes divine,
right,
which is very interesting, I guess, dimension to the non-dual philosophy traditions generally, but also to the non-dual Buddhist traditions, which is, I think, approached through doctrine of two truths. You know, it's approached through us being able to balance that vision of the ultimate with a practical vision that helps us actually to still live a wholesome life, and one in which we take responsibility.
Yeah,
and that's what I wanted to mention as well, is that this, I guess what you would say in deep ecology circles, what you spoke about in the sense of this kind of village scale engagement, this is a movement that in the US they refer to as bioregionalism. And Gary Snyder is someone who's spoken a lot about this, written a lot about this. And he basically says, you know, dig in, find your place on the planet, but take responsibility from there. Not just for that tiny place, but from that place, from your understanding of the local, returning to that connection with everything through where you are now. And this, for me, comes through very strongly in Indigenous wisdom in Australia in particular.
Yeah, of course,
this really deepening into connection with country and the place where you are, understanding the seasons where you are, and taking responsibility for and from that connection, which I feel like it was very, very important for us to understand. And for what it's worth, I think that is, as a starting place, I mean, where else can we start but where we are? If we get caught in the sort of the enormity of the problem, perhaps it's too easy to throw up our hands and say, oh, there's nothing that we can do. Run from
it. It really is a classic image. Yeah. Everyone's throwing up their hands, run away from the fire at the cop. Yeah.
But if we are taking that invitation that I feel the Buddha has offered us, that he's really saying that our, in understanding our world, where we dwell, the systems that support us, what we are really doing is understanding our own mind, coming to terms with the systems that operate within us that give rise to our actions, whether they are wholesome action or based in ignorance, greed.
And I can, from a Buddhist point of view, like I was talking about the language of divinity before. In Buddhism, we don't so much use that language of divinity, but we use the language of Dhamma, right? And so, but then this, if we use the language of Dhamma, then the same thing applies, because it's the Dhamma which is throughout nature, and Dhamma, in fact, can be a word for nature, and that's how nature is. So and the Dhamma is also inside us, and the Dhamma is also that which liberates. So that which liberates and that which is the Buddha's teachings is also that which is in nature. And there's, you know, such a strong tradition of that within Buddhism, right? That's the kind of normal thing that Buddhist monastics do and so on, is to I'm out of here and head out into the hills and the caves and into the forest, and you find that refuge there. And there's something about it which is deeply meaningful. And we don't tend to frame meditation and so on explicitly in that context, but you can see it shining through things like Mahakasapa's verses in the Theragata. I don't know if you read the Mahakasapa's verse in the Theragata.
Not that I can recall them this moment.
I should share them with you. It's awesome because Kasapa has this reputation of being like really kind of rigid, hard line, strict monk, you know. And then his verses are all like, oh, my heart delights to be in these forests with the mountains are full of mists and the butterflies are flying, and I love nothing more than to go up these mountains and to sit meditation and to hear the pitter-patter of the rain. It's astonishing. Mm. It's actually one of the world's first beautiful nature poetry. And you just see that difference, you know, and that kind of gruff exterior is just melted when he goes into the forest.
Mm.
And there's something about that sense of connection. And it's one of the things that I feel that, you know, it's also, it makes it difficult because we're all living in cities and it's hard, like our knowledge of nature is mediated through David Attenborough and through a screen and these kinds of things. I feel this is even more true for younger people, right? The more it goes on, then the further we are from nature. And I don't know if there's anything we can do about that because, you know, yeah.
Well, this is a very interesting question, and it's something that I have just recently. I was down at a gathering in Victoria of deep ecology practitioners, facilitators, in a kind of an effort to not only go through some of these processes with one another, but also to vision how we might engage more, organize better, and. This question of, oh, well, if only we could get more people reconnecting with nature, taking walks in the forest, walking quietly and listening to bird song. Of course, you know, nature, she's such a Dhamma teacher in that sense. You know, it shows us directly the interconnection of all life.
Mm-hmm.
But most of us live in cities, as you showed, so how do we do that? But for me, one of the things that I find most kind of awe-inspiring and this kind of sense of awe and reverence that you refer to as being somehow key, that's our connection to divinity and the power that has on not just in the sense of, you know, we feel nourished by going into nature, but then we feel some sense of our smallness, but also the importance of the responsibility we have. I feel like those are connected, you know, the impact that sort of experience can have.
Also another aspect of Dhamma, because Dhamma is also your responsibility.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So it comes for me, brings me back to this recognition, and this is actually one of the first things that I experienced doing the body contemplation, the 32 parts, the Ashubha contemplation, was not being repulsed, but actually feeling awe. Actually feeling awe at the complexity and impossibility of the apparent more or less cooperation of all of these incredible systems that make up a human body. So really, in order to go to a wild place, you don't really have to go very far. You just have to look into your own body and mind. To connect to nature, there are rivers, you know, to as awe-inspiring as the Amazon. There are jungles in there of, you know, interconnection and life, pulsating life, that connects you in an unbroken chain to the very birth of the cosmos, let alone just the evolution of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are stardust. This kind of themes come through very strongly in some of the deep ecology process.
Right.
So maybe this is something that we can start to bring out more, how actually we are connecting to nature every time we sit and breathe, every time we stop and take a moment to do that. We are reconnecting with nature.
And this is actually fundamental to how the Buddha taught, especially the four elements meditation.
Mm.
And the four elements meditation is, I see this earth inside myself, and we go through and we spend time, right? because we are disconnected from our bodies, we're disconnected from our physical reality.
And it's tactile when right? we're doing that. It's not right? a concept. It's
exactly.
Not a, it's not a picture in a
That's
book.
That's right, yeah. Like my meditation teacher, Ajahn Chah Chai, would always say, Tung Lu, Tung Hen, means both know and see.
Mm.
So when you're investigating your body like that, you have to both know and see. So you have to, and you feel, you experience all that hardness, and then you you consider that hardness outside you, which partly also you feel, right? The seat that you're sitting on, the ground that your feet are touching, and you feel that earth element, and then you extend that out until it covers the whole earth. And then once you've done that, then this earth element is just the same as that earth element. And that earth element's the same as this earth element, and you break down that difference. We're just the earth element. And so that idea of like breaking down that boundary between self and other is that's actually absolutely. Straight out of the suttas. That's exactly how the Buddha taught that earth element. Because then, you know, we're letting go of attachment to our own personal identity, which comes back to the thing you mentioned before about the shallow environmentalism being about like what is nature for us, which already presupposes that we are separate from nature. Yeah. And if once we start to see ourselves as a living part of the system that is nature, then we want to flourish as an organ in that, just as our organs want to flourish in a healthy way inside us. And we don't see, you know, our left kidney fighting with our right kidney to say which one can have more. Right, we don't see our heart fighting with our lungs to say which one's going to win. Everything
is more important,
right? And but that's what we're doing in the world. We're excavating things, we're destroying things, on and on it goes. And we lose that sense. We not only lose nature, but we lose ourselves.
Mm.
Yeah.
Indeed, and this is, for me, it connects actually to our question that came through in the beginning. This idea of spiritual bypassing and trauma actually is quite closely related to the deep ecology process. Actually, Joanna Macy, facing the situation that she recognized in the nuclear in the arms race, it was happening in the 80s, 90s. And working with people in that domain, recognized that there was an enormous amount of grief and pain in those who were dealing with or facing up to this kind of the reality of this situation. You know, the maybe some of us here also kind of lived through those times where, you know, in the news it was recognized that, you know, at any moment someone could push a button. You know, it was like a hair trigger situation. You have the Cuban Missile Crisis, these kind of things. And she saw how in group process, groups of activists working on these kinds of issues, if they were given an opportunity to express that, to turn towards that suffering, rather than pretending that it wasn't there, they could re-energize. It wasn't that they became overwhelmed. They were able to kind of integrate that experience and from it draw energy to engage with the work that they were doing. So she started to explore that more deeply and recognized actually that there were a lot of traditionally, human beings had a lot of processes for coming into contact with deep suffering and integrating it in a helpful way, in a way that didn't cause them to numb out or become overwhelmed. And so this work has kind of been interwoven into deep ecology work. We actually start most of the processes in gratitude for what we have, kind of like a metta cultivation, if you like, as a place to recognize the enormous blessings that we've received, what we can be grateful for. But then we look at what is our pain for the world, and we honor that. We don't seek to cut it off from our experience, but look at it and value it also as just a part of being a human being in a body and a mind in a world of interdependence and impermanence. And this, from that deriving a strength. So for me it relates to this question about spiritual bypassing. If we are actually able to turn towards and take care of our suffering, then we find not just more suffering, but we find actually relief. And for me, the way it connects very importantly is just looking at our patterns of consumption. And maybe this is something we can each do from time to time, is reflect on to what extent our consumption, which at the end of the day is the source of our impact individually and collectively on the world. What we are, the resources that we are claiming for ourselves, as opposed to being willing to share with other life.
Right.
How much of that consumption is distraction from discomfort? How much of that is us looking for a way out of something that is just a little bit uncomfortable or unpleasant? Oh, if I just have a little bit more of this, then I'll feel better. So this turning away rather than turning towards, I feel like the Buddha was also indicating to us that actually we are just adding to the problem, not finding true relief from it if we are unable to look clearly at it.
I think one thing is, in what you're saying there is that like a turning towards that suffering, but that turning towards suffering has to be done like intentionally and with a context.
And with wisdom.
And with some wisdom, right? Yeah, there has to be like a holding. I think we have like this ambient distress from like scrolling and stuff like that. Oh, this bad thing has happened and that bad thing has happened. And then we kind of also have this kind of ambient sense of guilt because we know we're participating in a world that is actually leading to these things. We're all part of the problem. And, you know, and so all of that kind of becomes part of that underlying distress, which is not really seen. And then, as you said, then multiplies and leads to more and more dysfunctional behavior, which sort of, you know, goes into that kind of spiral. So there needs to be time to actually make space and to just sit and face it. And it doesn't have to be all the time, right? It's not saying you have to go around constantly immersed in your sense of environmental destruction of everything. But there has to be a time to be able to face it and say, yeah, this is what's going on, and to actually have a reckoning with it. And that just on the you mentioned about the nuclear thing, of course, just as a quick reminder for everyone, there are still like lots of nukes around the place, but at least we can rest assured that they're in safe and responsible hands. And they would never do anything as crazy as like give these to raging narcissistic psychopaths with impulse control problems. That wouldn't happen, would it?
I think this is a really important point, but I suppose that for me, where I get to with this, the kind of application of, if you like, you know, the Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path to this question of environmental grief is not a turning towards the intellectual version of that, you know, like our news feeds and our media streams telling us, because they inherently, by their very nature, they are a product for consumption, something that we are being sold because of the power that they have to make us continue to click and scroll. The suffering that I'm talking about turning towards is the one that arose before you reached for the phone. What was it that was alive in you before you looked for that? Because in and of itself, that scrolling, that doom scrolling, is a distraction, perhaps. This is a question that we can ask ourselves. A distraction from something else that might need attention in our lives.
Right.
And it's finding that kind of gateway to relate to our experience that I think holds a key for us to then moderate our consumption, not just of our social media feeds, which incidentally have a direct impact on our mental health and well-being and that kind of ambient distress.
Right.
Which I love that term, ambient distress. But it's the gateway for us to look again at how we are consuming the actual, you know, resources that we understand to be finite. You know, we talk about these.
But even that's resources again, right? We're consuming resources, aka destroying nature.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But I think there's a scale that we use to say if imagine the renewable resources, the renewable kind of life support systems that we have, if we imagine them pass it out into a year's worth of what we need to survive renewably. Generally speaking, I think at this time we run out by around June, July, like as a planet. And after that, what we're doing is eating into next year's, to future generations' life support systems. So it's that understanding, if we are able to, just in our own lives, we don't need to necessarily have a consciousness of that on the day-to-day. We don't need to add that to our ambient distress beyond just recognizing that the choices that I make in my daily life, my actions, have consequences. This is the teaching of karma.
Can I play Mara's advocate on that point?
Please.
Yeah. So this is a kind of conventional kind of wisdom. Okay, if we use that's great. And look, I'm a monk. That's kind of my whole thing for a while now has been that, you know, I've got one set of robes and, you know, have few possessions.
Biodegradable
robes, hand spun by Sri Lankan village women. But I don't know. I kind of, as I get older and more cynical, I kind of begin to think that that's the story that they want us to believe, that when we use less, that there'll be less harm. Whereas in fact, what happens is that when we use less, that they use more.
Mm.
So during the whole time that we've been doing this, for example, inequality has been massively multiplying. Mm. And the super rich in America, I think, made $1 trillion in the last year or something like that.
Mm.
Whatever, I can't remember the numbers. And so there's this massive expansion of consumption by the super rich, which the demand for things like fossil fuels is so elastic that if you stop using it in one area, somebody else will use it up. It doesn't mean that less people are using it. And this is something that really struck me a few years ago. It was about 2017, 2018, something like that.
Mm.
And I happened to come across an end of year report from Exxon, and they sort of somehow shared or whatever. So I was reading this end of year report by Exxon, and one of the things in there really stuck with me. They said that because of increasing consumer resistance to plastics, we shall have to put more effort into finding non-consumer facing uses for plastics.
Mm.
Right? That's their response to it. Mm. Not that, yeah, they've got a point, we shouldn't be making so much plastics, but we've got to hide it from people, so they're not going to protest it. So think about that when we talk about things like let's not have plastic shopping bags and those kinds of things. Great. But it doesn't mean that there's going to be less plastic use. It means they're going to hide it from you.
Mm.
And so, yeah, this is the kind of thing that I'm always kind of thinking when we're talking about like personal responsibility. It always seems to me actually what we really need is we need government regulations that's going to actually force people to stop doing the things that they're doing because, yeah. Well, I don't know what you think about that. Go on. There's another point I wanted to make, but go on if you can.
Well, I suppose, I mean, on the personal level, I mean, definitely taking the point that you make about the importance for like an integrated approach. But is that not just what Mara would say?
I would be Mara.
Yeah, you were saying, you know, speaking from Mara. And I guess for me, I was like, yeah, of course Mara would say
such fair enough, thing, fair cop,
yeah. In the sense that why would you, you know, choose to be living with less impact when of course, you know, you're your neighbor is just going to do their thing anyway.
Right.
For me, this is just like the kind of the classic get out, avoiding the cold hard fact. The only person whose behavior I can hope to change is my very own.
Mm.
Like there is no reasonable basis to expect that I'm going to be able to have more than kind of a passing influence on anyone else's massive history of interconnected causes and conditions that
I've been a Dhamma teacher for 30 years and I can confirm that that is correct.
Right. But I would have to say in your defense that there is no better way to aspire to having that positive influence than having first worked on yourself. Like the engagement of your whole being, not just intellect, with even a conversation can be life-changing for another person rather than some kind of top-down directive, kind of intellectualized or command and control kind of mentality, which, I mean, governments have tried that as for environmental solutions, right? And it clearly, this is where the the lack of need for more ecological ideas come in, and the need for ecological identity.
Yeah.
It's when it comes from the own side, when it's instinctive, a felt kinship with other beings through things like metta cultivation, that we can start to have, you know, make change, impactful change in our own lives, first of all. So, yes, I think it, Mara has a point, but I think it's also the same argument can be used in any number of situations as an excuse for not doing the work, for just facing up to the fact that here is where it begins. And who knows? Karma is an amazing thing. Who knows what the ripple effects might be? And the unpredictability of systems that are complex and adaptive, of which human beings are just one small part, also gives me a lot of, I guess you would call it hope.
Oh, they're unpredictability, right? They're non-linear.
Yeah, actually, it's very difficult to predict what can happen if you know, some fruit is tasted by certain, you know, individuals, and they feel inspired to engage wholeheartedly. The power that has is inherently unpredictable, and could be enormously influential. We just cannot predict.
Right.
I mean, if we were to look back 10 years and imagine the world, would you have imagined that it was like it is now, in both the positive and the negative sense?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Very difficult to predict. Easy to get caught in the dominant kind of ambient distress of paradigm, but I feel like we have an enormous potential as human beings also.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for that. And I think that also works, like, on the flip side. Like, if you say, you know, if you say the change has to start with yourself, it also, I think, flips over and says, well, if you don't have the personal integrity to make those changes yourself, how do you expect anybody else to do that? And I'd expect anyone to listen to it.
Right? Indeed,
I mean, it's not sufficient, but it's a necessary condition. You have to be able to, do that, to live with yourself.
Yeah.
And it's about just like who you are, that you can be somebody who's going to live in that kind of way. And I think if you come from, like, from what we were talking about earlier, like contentment, and you're coming from a sense of self-confidence and contentment and joy in the simple things, right? If you're happy, if you're just happy to, you know, have friends and to see the trees and to breathe and to have the Dhamma and all of these things, which are incredible, then you're already not going to be orientating your life towards just consuming more and more and more. Yeah.
Indeed.
Just on what you said before about the unpredictability of things, there was this came up on social media just the other day. There's a book called, I don't remember, a new book on climate change. I can't remember what it's called. And they used the example of Mr. Creosote from Monty Python to illustrate non-linear changes.
Oh.
Do you remember Mr. Creosote?
Is that the restaurant scene?
It is just a thin wafer.
Thin. Oh my goodness. Okay.
So those of you from a certain generation will remember. Andrew will remember that. But then we grew up. There was a defining moment of our childhood. But anyway, I'll let you look up Mr. Creosote on YouTube afterwards if you want to know what that's about. But to illustrate that same point, non-linear changes, right? That these things happen, and of course can happen in a bad way, right? I feel like such a sense of peril when I'm looking at the world, because we are just overloading the systems, constantly overloading systems, constantly demanding more and more and more from the earth systems, and there comes a point when any system will collapse. It just happens, you know. A more classic non-linear system would be heating water. You heat it and heat it and heat it, and you can predict what's going to happen more or less. And that's what our science has been able to do with the climate so far, is to predict more or less what's going to be happening. But in the last few years, it seems that's breaking down. Now, in the last few years, the actual observed temperatures have been far in excess of that which had been predicted by the latest models, CMIP6 models. And it's like on the top, like 1 in 10,000 percentile or something like that of what we could be predicted by the models. And so perhaps it's just an anomaly, or perhaps the systems are starting to break down so that we can no longer, the water's starting to boil. So we can no longer predict what's going to happen in the future from what's happened in the past. And that's when things become very scary. And it's got multiple indicators of this, like the collapse of the AMOC or the Arctic ice and so many other things. So this is where, like, we don't have like luxury of messing around with these things. And from a, you know, climate change perspective, we've always been saying we've got to keep the temperature below 2 degrees above historical temperatures. And then it was like 1 degree. We've got to keep it 1 degree, 1.5 degree by the end of the century. But on November the 8th this year, November the 8th marked the point when there were 3 consecutive years above 1.5 degrees. Mm. Yeah. And that was not, we were supposed to avoid that by the end of the century.
Mm.
Yeah. And so this is what I mean. We're now way escaped what the models have been predicting. Mm. So this is not something that we should be just messing around with, or it's not just like a, it's not something to just, it's not just an idea to play with or just a nice thing to think about. It's an urgent call for us to question how we are living, who we are as people on this earth, how we see ourselves, and what kinds of choices are we going to make? Because there is just one planet and that can support life. And we can just go down there. Like, you can literally get a shovel and dig down and reach the end of life. I don't know how far it goes down, but like a few meters. It's not that far. And that's it. And you can literally go up there, a couple of kilometers or something like that, and then that's the end of life. That's it. And then after that, it's just space. And the thing about space is it's great in the movies because they just make stuff up like warp speed and faster FTL drives and all of these things, and it's fantastic. But in real life, those things don't exist. And what does exist is just nothing going on forever and trying super hard to kill you all the time. That's it. And all we have is this one planet here. And this planet Earth is like a bowling ball that somebody has left in a damp space, and it's got a thin layer of mold on the surface of the bowling ball. And that's it. That's life on Earth. That's it. And that's how fragile we are. And everything else is just death and blackness and freezing cold. So if we mess this up, we don't get another chance. Yeah, we this is it. We have got so much, and we just look around us. We have so much. It's incredible. It's incredible. We can just sit here and just breathe, and oxygen goes into our lungs. Are you kidding me? Do you know how rare that is? There's like literally nowhere else in the universe, as far as we know, that you can do that. Anywhere else in the universe, you breathe in, you're dead. That's it. That's it. It's not complicated. Here we can do that. It's incredible. And unless we learn to live here and to live with this life, then all of these things that we love are going to be lost. And all of our capacity, all of the wonderful humanity, the things that we value about humanity are going to be undercut, and all of those connections with life and with our ability to sustain ourselves on the planet are going to be lost. So, yeah, anyway, we've got a couple of nonsensical comments on here. Thanks. Darth Vader rises against. Thanks for that. Galaxies far, far away. Look, maybe there are galaxies far, far away, hopefully, but we're not going there. Sorry about that. Venerable, do you have any comments to finish up?
Yeah, I think that for me, one of fruitful cultivations or domains that we find in the deep ecology group work, and I think speaks to how important it is for us to have kind of personal practice that you know, this kind of start where you are sort of approach are the Brahma Viharas, like as a kind of a whether you follow kind of a bodhisattva approach or not, these cultivations, these practices that open us towards kinship with the web of life through an attitude of friendliness that allow us to resonate with suffering that other beings feel, that allow us to tap into the compassion that makes us human, the joy that we can experience recognizing the enormous gifts that we are offered by not just other human beings but by other living beings, living systems. This and equanimity, I think, are really important practices. The possibility to be nourished when I choose, not just when the external presents itself to me in that way, but to be able to choose when to focus on the good in other human beings, rather than just being at the mercy of an algorithm that might choose to show me something inspiring from time to time, but otherwise is showing me the dark side of what's happening in the world. And the recognition that we can, by definition, only do the possible. That because of interdependent co-arising, that which arises does so because conditions are sufficient. That which passes does so because conditions are no longer sufficient. And if I'm able to be with that aspect of experience while still maintaining a sense of kinship, compassion, and joy at the amazing gifts that I am being offered, then it stands me in a much better place to engage with the collective challenges that we face as communities, as a society, as a planet, let alone just the day-to-day, just the challenges that I face as an individual in my life, in relationships. Those ingredients are the same. The tools are the same. And I feel like that is the enormous gift that the Dharma offers us, the possibility to have some agency there, to not just be at the mercy of the currents of history and the situation that we find ourselves in collectively, our collective karma, but to have an opportunity, that karma offers me an opportunity to change what is happening because of the necessity of cause and effect, that actually no matter what I do...
Keep going.
No matter what I do, it will have an impact. I cannot avoid having some ripple effect. What I can do is choose the nature of that effect, whether it is a wholesome ripple effect or an unwholesome ripple effect, whether it contributes to the problem or goes towards some kind of healing, whether that's individual or collective. So for me, those are key practices, key understandings, and they derive from the fundamental cultivation of awareness. In order to have choice, to have agency, I need to be aware of what the situation is that I'm in, what is arising here and now. So, yeah, that's all I would share. And I'm wondering, time-wise, if some of these are questions, and maybe
we can have a quick look at these questions. Thanks for that, Venerable. No, just somebody delivering a pizza.
Oh. Oh, that was me. How can I? Deliveroo, is that right?
Someone's delivering a pizza, right? Oh. So I go out and say, and then she's like, oh, what are you doing in there? I'm doing Buddhist meditation. Oh, really? Yeah, you can come.
Oh, great.
So then she's hopefully coming.
Come next time.
It's good. Okay, great. So from, let's note quickly some of the comments we've got here from our wonderful online people. Sumana, there is a pleasure in the pathless woods. There is a rapture on the lonely shore. There is society where none intrudes by the deep sea and music in its roar. I love not man the less, but nature more.
Mm.
Wow. So from LB, universal energy complies with all rhythms of fluxing components of combustible gases and synchronic forces of entering and escaping existence of evolution, experiences and birth entering of change and effects as I see it. LB, if I understood what that meant, I would almost certainly agree with you. But I'm not exactly sure that I do. But I do think I get what you're saying, like that's this idea of like the movement of energies and forces and so on, right? both the existences of evolution, experiences, and birth, entering of change and effects. Yeah, one of the stories that I tell in this regard, like a few years ago, I had the opportunity to meet a fellow called Noel Nanup. He's an Aboriginal elder from in Perth. So the Nanups come from Geraldton, which is where my family was.
Okay.
So yeah, I mentioned to him. I said, "Oh, you know, my grandfather was Ned Pinder." He said, "Oh yeah, you look like him."
Okay.
And which I think means I'm bald and white, but we sat down to talk, and the first thing he said, we haven't talked about Buddhism or anything. The first thing he said was, you know, the thing you have to understand about Aboriginal philosophy.
Should I close that?
Yeah, do you want to? You're right, Jillian?
I'm right.
No. No? Cheers. It usually happens at a certain point. And he said, the thing you have to understand about Aboriginal philosophy is that it's all about impermanence.
Yep.
And then he went on to talk about that, because you have to understand nature and your place in nature in terms of change, because this year is never the same as the next year, and that wind is never the same as this wind, and this rain is never the same as that rain. So it's not about understanding the things that are fixed, it's understanding about the change in things. And we just talked about that for quite some time.
Wow.
So anyway, thanks for that, LB.
Just to add to that, I'm involved with a group, Gaia Forest Project, and also yatra.org. We run silent walking retreats in beautiful wild places in Australia, New Zealand, and who knows where else. And we try our best to have traditional owners welcome us onto country when we're doing them in Australia. And we just did a beautiful one in the Yuragir Coast, a fantastic piece of coastline in the mid-north coast of New South Wales.
Okay.
Biggest stretch of protected coastline in New South Wales.
Wow.
And we have a beautiful connection with the local Yagle elder, Auntie Glenda, and she welcomes us onto country. People are usually still getting tears in their eyes when they talk about the welcome at the end of the walk. They've, you know, walked 60 kilometres down the beach and they're still thinking about the welcome. And one of the things that she shares, not just that sense of connection and the recognition of change, but that if we walk on country in a way that is open to it, we not only feel a love for country, but we are able to receive love from country. So I would maybe add that in my limited understanding, it's about love and impermanence as well.
You know, absolutely.
That it's a reciprocity of relationship and connection.
We're
all connected to country. Every time you flush the toilet, you're connected to country.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship to country is what is being spoken about.
Yeah,
and this is that I'm quoting another Indigenous academic who's here at UTS, I think.
Auntie Fran.
No, his name is slipping my mind, but he offered a workshop on those kind of concepts at a recent convention that I went to. Not the Metta convention, a different different one. But I'm really touched to hear that recognition of impermanence as well.
So Simran mentions she went downstairs to get some food. Dad's watching Gardening Australia. A man from Venezuela created this huge garden in his backyard with Buddha statues in it. And he talked about how nature is medicine and healed him, how he meditates there every morning, and that he loves peace, so his garden offers that for him. Yeah, really nice. Thanks for that. Nikki says, come and speak at Rising Tide in Newcastle in a week.
Okay. I'm going.
Mel's going. Are you going?
if someone can help me to arrange that, I would happily speak at Rising Tide. I don't know that I would just grab a megaphone and try to railroad. They are amazingly well organized, Rising Tide.
Right.
If you've ever thought about taking direct action but hesitated, Rising Tide is the moment for you to be very, very held in a beautiful emergence of speaking truth to power in a very cohesive, collective way.
So that's happening
community.
Next weekend in Newcastle, and that's like one of the biggest environmental actions. All the kayaks and so on will be going out.
Something for everyone there. You don't have to put yourself in a kayak on the front line. You can support in so many different ways. It's an amazing emergence.
So Chandima mentions, isn't that the nature of samsara anyway, Bhante? There is no safe place. Urgency towards abandoning greed and delusion increases when I think like that. Yes, so this is true. It's like yes, we know things are impermanent, but did they have to be quite that impermanent? Yeah.
Oh, bye-bye.
See you later. That little boy has been giving Ghana since before he was born.
I think he came to a workshop at the gave in the convention.
I bet he did. Yeah,
metta.
Okay.
Loving kindness, compassion.
So Kaz says, beautiful talk. Thanks very much, Bhante and Venerable. Marion says, Bhante, I totally agree with everything you say, except for the tense, if we mess it up. I feel it's more realistic to say we have messed this up and destroyed everything. Okay, fair enough. And life and future lives will be more and more burning. Human lives and conditions will be closer and closer to hell conditions. Look, I agree with you, and I think that, you know, there is so much harm that's been done already. I mean, there is millions of people who've died because of climate change, because of the harms we've done to the environment. And for those people, making things better now is actually not going to help. And there's so many species that have become extinct, forests that have been chopped down. There's been so much diminution and harm done to the planet already that, you know, it's not a matter of, you know, harms are not potential. So, yeah, thanks for that.
I guess I would just add also that I think one of the things that we can sort of see manifesting at the moment is how quickly in fear and separation, yeah, we inadvertently take up the weapons of Mara, actually. Yeah. Like that we fall into old patterns of division, disunity, othering, finding someone to blame, despair, and hopelessness, when actually that bowling ball and that thin rind of life has been here before, actually maybe half a dozen times already, and has found a way, has survived. So I guess I would ask the question, you know, in questioning the tense that we use, that, you know, have we already messed this up? Are we sure? Mm. What information do we have unequivocally about the future? None. We don't know actually what will happen. Certainly it's going to be very painful for a lot of living beings for some time to come, but the capacity for life to regenerate is a hallmark of life, actually. Sure. It's what life does, is finds a way. And so for me,
I mean, even in like the worst possible outcome of everything environmentally and nuclear war and everything, we can do everything, blow up all the nuclear bombs, do everything, the Earth will still be better than anywhere else in the universe for life.
And in fact, has been there before, perhaps 5 or 6 times, and found a way, life finds a way. So, I feel like the invitation is for us to recognize the incredible opportunity we have being alive in this time. In some sense, perhaps we have chosen to be alive in this time. What is it that we bring to this opportunity? Is it despair, or is it a willingness to turn towards the difficulty and maintain connection, stay in kinship with other beings? Mm. Or do we choose to find someone to blame? And, you know, we see that, you know, climate conflicts are real, you know, happening around the world.
Sure,
destabilization, causing people to think only in terms of scarcity and, bloodshed results. So I feel like this is very alive for us at the moment, how we respond.
So just a couple of links there from Michael, who's dropped in a couple of links to Healing Land in Sydney and a podcast on bioregioning. So, and some other thoughts and thanks from everyone online. So thanks everybody online for joining in that conversation. Mm. Thanks for everybody here. We will wrap up now. Thanks, Venerable Tenzin. Right? That was amazing. Yeah. And Venerable mentioned his Dhamma Yatra. So he's doing cross-country walks with a Dhamma theme. Check it out. Where do they check it out?
So our project to create space for nature connection, deep ecology and Buddhist retreat is in a place called the Dorrigo Plateau, mid-north coast of New South Wales, the hinterland. There it's called Gaia Forest, G-A-I-A, this
Gaia Forest,
wonderful divinity beneath us, gaiaforest.org. And in collaboration with yatra.org.au, yatra being pilgrimage, sacred journey, we also work together creating these opportunities for walking, silent bushwalking retreats with yoga, meditation, and a little bit of deep ecology usually
woven
in. That's yatra.org. Yatra.org.au. Well, at Gaia Forest, we also run those events, walks, and collaborate.
Great. thank you so much for that. Mm. And we're also planning a retreat, hopefully next year, out past Broken Hill.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so if anybody, we'll keep you updated for details of that.
Wonderful. Should come, yeah,
if you can. Mm-hmm. And Venerable, if you want to come and join us. Broken Hill's what Australians we call warp warp. So, yeah. Anyway.
Do we have time for any questions here? Or are we really kind
I think
of
we should wrap up
now?
Yeah, oh, okay. Normally we're wrapping up before this time. So, look, thanks, everybody, for your attention. Thanks for being here. Thank you for sharing your presence. It's always an honor to have people come and share space, to hold space for Dharma. So thank you so much. Mm. And we will see you next week. We'll be back at Crow's Nest at 7 and back here at 7 on Friday. And check the Lokanta website for updates as far as the program for next year. Mm. So.